make sure that.
Okay. All right, so we'll move on. Is it echoey to anybody else? All
No.
good? Okay. Let's see. Dr. Trong.
Here. Dr. Trong here.
I can't quite hear you. You're a little soft.
Oh, okay. Can you hear me now?
Yep, that's a little better.
Okay, sorry about that. Hi, Dr. Trong here. I'm the local pediatric dentist in the community. The fun thing I'm going to do this summer is taking my kids camping, which will start this weekend.
All right, where are you going?
Oh, it's someplace local. I think probably the Battleground, that state park around
All
Battleground.
right, great. All right, thank you. Mark Collier. Don't see Mark. Marla Sanger.
So, my fun thing, my role on FAC is as a community representative, as a consumer of public health services. So that is my role. I started with FAC as a representative of Peace Health quite a few years ago. So anyway, I'm excited about my fun thing because it's coming up pretty soon. We're going to, my husband and I have a little house in Alaska, and we're going to have our grandson and his mommy and daddy will be coming along with for the ride too. So we're expecting to have quite a blast taking him out in the boat and letting him drive all around in the ocean. And I'm sure he's just gonna love it.
And that's in Alaska, right?
In Alaska, Southeast Alaska, all around on the west side of Prince of Wales Island, if, for those who might be familiar.
Hey, Michael Watkins.
Good evening. I'm Michael Watkins, the tribal manager for the Cowlitz Indian Tribe, and we'll be taking a trip to Arley, Montana to an powwow this summer. So,
Nice.
and probably a few more outdoor powwows and just spending a little bit more outdoor time.
That sounds like great fun. Nissan Buchanan. See.
Hello, my name's Nissa. I'm the nurse representative, and my fun plans for the summer are a trip to San Diego. My boys are big baseball fans, so we're going to see the Padres. So it'll be pretty fun.
Great. All right. Paul Childers.
Paul Childers here, and I represent the restaurants of Southwest Washington. And when summer arrives, I am concentrated on yard work. Doesn't sound too much fun to some people, but I enjoy it. I really enjoy all the everything is blue in bloom, that's where I am. That's where
All
you'll
right.
find me.
Sounds great. Thanks, Paul. Let's see. I'm next on the list. I'm Sandy Brown, and I re represent consumers of the public services, health services, and I'm chair of the FAC. And my summer fun is two long camping trips. One of them starts next week to southeastern Oregon and John Day area, and the second one in September to southern Idaho and northern Nevada. So we'll be doing some camping this summer. Scott Johnson.
I'm Scott Johnson. I'm the representative from Clark Regional Emergency Services Agency. Summer tends to be a lot more busy for us at work. So, my summer fun is looking forward to the first big rain in October.
Okay, good.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Works for me.
All right. Tracy Fernandez, you're a new member tonight. We'll introduce you here in a minute, but you're next on the list.
Hi, I'm Tracy Fernandez. I'm representing Peace Health, and my summer fun is just a few small little getaways. But my most important one starts this weekend when my son and my 10-month-old grandson are coming to visit, so I'm excited about that. So,
Nice. Nice. All right, and welcome.
thank you.
Tyler Clary.
Tyler Clary. I represent water utilities here in Clark County. And summer fun, similar to Elma. I'm looking forward to some boating and water skiing and wakeboarding.
Good. All right. I don't see Councillor Marshall. Dr. Melnick.
Hi, everybody. Alan Melnick. I'm the public health director and health officer. I've already had a little bit of summer fun. I just got back from a trip to Montana for a family wedding, and the newlyweds will be coming and visiting over the Labor Day weekend, which I think is still technically summer. So sure. Looking forward to that opportunity.
Great. All right. Dr. Maupin, did I see you rejoin us?
Are you saying me? Yes?
Yes.
Oh, hi. Yes.
Oh, that's much better.
Okay. Yes. I logged out and been again. Whatever was going on is gone. I just returned from a family reunion in Bend yesterday. And then the rest of my year is packed. Briefly, I have a spa getaway to Scottsdale in August, 10 days to San Diego in August, a trip to Vegas in September, a trip to Seaside at the end of September, and then 10 days at the National Bridge Championships in Vegas in December.
Wow, you've got a lot of fun ahead of you.
Yeah.
Good. All right. Let's see. Andrea Pruitt.
Hi there. My name is Andrea Pruitt. I'm the Community Health Director at Clark County Public Health. And I would say sunshine and camping with my two kiddos and doing some gardening this summer. So, yeah, looking forward to it.
All right. Jerry Preston.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Jerry Preston. I'm the Environmental Public Health Director for Clark County. And after several baseball games this summer, we're planning to go to Silverwood in Idaho with the family.
That'll be fun. Jeff Harbison.
Hello, everybody. Jeff Harbison. I'm the Administrative Services Director for Clark County Public Health. I've got a couple of concerts, including the Zac Brown Band and Kenny Chesney up in Seattle, and then Chris Stapleton in Ridgefield, and I'm going to the Big Island in August.
Ooh.
And a quick trip to Palm Springs in September. So that's everything before summer ends. So
that's a lot of fun. All right, Roxanne.
Hi, everybody. I'm Roxanne Wolf. I'm the deputy director. And my summer fun plan is I'm going to go see my sister in Santa Cruz, hopefully in July, if everything works out. So
great. All right. Mallory.
Hi, I'm Mallory Berry, Executive Administrative Assistant, sorry. my summer fun plans are just Sun River, lots of camping with my husband and kids, mostly just enjoying the sunshine, quite honestly.
Great. All right. Bridget.
I wasn't sure I was going. I have two kids that play baseball, so just trying to continue loving that activity. Spending time in the yard, riding bikes, just enjoying the sun in the local area. Kind of similar to the other person who was talking about. This is our busiest time of year, so I'm kind of just waiting for it to get over.
You'll have some winter fun.
Yes.
All right. Well, it sounds like we've all got some great plans for the summer. And did I get everybody? Did I miss anyone?
Dana Nguyen. I'm the Investigation and Response Director at Clark County Public Health. Summer plans, renovating my beach house.
Ooh, that sounds like work.
I think we also have Jeremy Martin, who's joining us from our food team, too. I saw his name as well.
Hi, can you see me? I'm Jeremy Martin. I'm here with Bridget and representing the food team. And as far as summer goes, camping with the family. So,
all right.
Thank you.
And I'm here too. Brianne Scarlett Pfizer with Legacy Salmon Creek Infection Prevention. I'm going to the Oregon Country Fair. I'm going to the Farewell Festival. I'm going to Chicago for a family reunion, and my oldest son is turning 16.
Ooh. All right. Well, thank you. Well, thanks, everybody. I think now we'll review the minutes. I think Mallory sent those out, and hopefully everybody had a chance to look them over. Does anybody have any comments, changes, or additions to the minutes? And you just lost everybody. And hearing no comments, can I entertain a motion and a second to approve the minutes from the May 28th meeting?
Move to approve.
Thank you, Tyler. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Okay, I think we got a second for Brianne. All those in favor, thumbs up or say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Okay, the minutes passed from the May 28th meeting. We do have some good news in that we've had two new members approved by the council. Lori Static, who represents Clark County Social and Human Services, and Tracy Fernandez. And Tracy is joining us tonight. And Dr. Melnick, are you prepared to introduce Tracy tonight?
I'd be happy to. Tracy was recently the interim CEO for the Peace Health Columbia Network. And I think you're now, if I have it correct, you're chief financial officer for Peace Health Southwest, Peace Health Columbia Network. Do I have that? I hope I have that correct.
Yes.
And it was really, really a great addition. It was wonderful. And I sit on the Peace Health Community Board, so I've gotten to know Tracy and really impressed and very excited that she's now on the Public Health Advisory Council as a Peace Health representative.
Oh, welcome, Tracy. We're glad to have you here, and I'm glad you could make it tonight. So Lori will be joining us at our next meeting in July, and between now and our next meeting, we will be having an orientation for Lori, Tracy, and Dr. Truong. And so they'll get kind of a more complete orientation to our group and what we're up to. So that will be happening in July. Do we have any public comment or public attendance tonight?
I do believe, who is on the 360-798-6456 number? Okay. I don't think we have any public members joining us tonight, Sandy.
Okay. All right. Sounds great. Well, our next agenda item is the public health and action. And Bridget Holland is with us tonight to talk about the food safety program and some of the events and things going on. And Dr. Melnick, would you like to introduce Bridget, please?
Let me unmute myself there. So yeah, Bridget Holland is a program manager with our food safety team. We also have Jeremy Martin, who's also another a program manager with our food safety team. And I think, I know that we're gonna hear about how we address temporary events and mobile food services and ensure safety of the public during these events. So I'll let them take it away.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you, everybody, for allowing me some time to talk with you tonight about food safety. I think, let's see, we're in the slide deck, get started here. Yep, next slide, please. Tomorrow, this presentation is being given by Dave and Craig at the Board of Health meeting. So they're on slide one, and I'm covering it tonight. So a main purpose of the food safety program is to help prevent foodborne illnesses from occurring in our community. Through plan review and inspection, we review steps involved with food storage, preparation, transportation, and service. So today I'm going to talk about the plan review and inspection around food service at events. Food service of most every kind is a permitted activity. We work with restaurants, concession stands, mobile food trucks, event vendors to help ensure that food safety practices are intact regardless of how or where the food is served. Major contributing factors of foodborne illness are considered and discussed during plan review and inspection of temporary event vendors, similar to the way that we cover those topics with all permit types. Food labels are viewed and food processes are talked about to verify that food qualifies as being from an approved source. The final cook temperatures of food is collected, and we look at thermometers to be sure that thermometers are present and that food workers know how to use them and that they are actually using them. We're checking to see that hot food is staying hot over 135 degrees, that cold food staying cold below 41. And we observe food workers to view for any cross-contamination or hygiene concerns throughout their service activities. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about inspections later on at the end of the presentation, but as a whole, that's the overview of what our program does. Next slide, please. So a lot of big events happen in the summer months. There's information here about some of the well-known, well-attended events. Food is an appeal at all of these events and more. Clark County is host to numerous runs, festivals, sporting events, you know, you name it, we have it. In addition to the heavy-hitting events here, we had food occur at over 220 events in Clark County in 2023. Most of the food service that's occurring outside of a normal restaurant setting is provided by food booths or food carts, food trailers, hot dog carts, and concession stands. The settings can be dynamic, more dynamic than a typical restaurant, and we offer permits specifically for those types of non-traditional restaurant food service. Slide, please. Thank you. So there are many types of permits that vendors can get to serve food at outdoor events. Let's see. So for vendors who attend different events throughout the year, they can get an annual permit to be multiple places year round. They'll be inspected several times a year. It's based on the complexity of their menu. And mobile food units are permitted similarly. They have a different permit name, but they get multiple inspections throughout the year based on the complexity of their permit. Another type of permit option is a temporary event permit. So anybody can apply for a temporary permit to serve food. Applicants could be vendors from outside the county attending a festival, or it could be a school group or a community group having their own event. Most vendors at the Clark County Fair actually are permitted through a temporary event permit. Anybody listening now could apply for a temporary event permit. And if you had the right setup and got through the plan approval, plan review process, you could be well on your way to serving food for the weekend. We put a lot of effort into communicating with event coordinators and vendors prior to events. We monitor public events in Clark County, and we work with event coordinators to make sure that all of the food vendors at their event have a permit. So to do that, we reach out to anybody who's advertising an event. If there's an event in the paper or on Facebook, anywhere we can find an advertisement, it's publicly advertised. If we can find a way to contact the event coordinator of that event, we will do that. And we will, you know, as soon as we can, so that we can offer ourselves to them as a resource to help their event, or at least the food portion of their event, run smoothly. We'll work with them to inform them of which vendors have a permit, which of their vendors have a permit, and who still needs one. And if they're willing to provide us contact information for their list of potential vendors, we'll reach out directly to those vendors and help make sure that they know about the costs and the permitting portal, and that they should apply within certain time frames to avoid a late fee and all of those things. Our goal is to solve problems well in advance of the event, and we are most effective at doing that by kind of having that active communication with people throughout the process, but definitely early on in the process. Slide, please. Once a temporary event permit is applied for, the permit is assigned, that work is assigned to a plan reviewer. The plan reviewer looks over the application, a food preparation plan for the menu, and the plan reviewer calls the applicant to review any outstanding questions that may have come from our review of their submittal. We talk with each applicant about the details of their menu, the food preparation steps, how and where they're going to do their food handling, and the physical setup of their booth. So the goal of this is to identify concerns on Tuesday at the office and have plenty of time for people to work out solutions before their inspection occurs on Saturday. Slide. And finally, the event day arrives. In our planning for conducting the actual inspection, we aim to inspect either as early in the day as we can or as early in the event as we can. This hopefully will allow the operators time to make any necessary corrections before they get really busy with customers. And it allows for serious concerns to be addressed before the majority of the people attending at the event have already eaten. So if we're doing inspections at the amphitheater, we're trying to do, you know, for a concert, we're trying to be there early before the concert starts, not the hour before the concert ends. The goal, the reason for that obviously is because the goal is to prevent illness. So on any given weekend in the summer months, we can have between 1 and 3 staff conducting inspections. There are some challenges unique to the outdoor setting. Some of those include keeping food cold in the summertime. Refrigeration can struggle. You might be like, refrigeration outside? You know, at the farmer's market, they some of the recurring events do have electricity set up for vendors, or vendors will come with their own generators. But refrigeration can struggle to perform, especially on hot days, and ice is often needed in large quantities. That's one of the things we'll run into is people bring ice. But if they're getting these 1 to 3 day permits, they're really not doing food service regularly and not doing it outside. They underestimate the amount of ice that you really need to keep food cold. And hot holding foods can actually be a challenge too. A lot of times food, the hot food is cooked in advance and then, you know, staged to the side for the order. And that can be really hard with wind and just the outdoor setting. It's not the same as being inside a building. And so allowing us to be there or us being there early allows there to be some troubleshooting so that they can reliably keep food hot and safe between cooking and service. At a lot of events, potable water and hot water is in limited supply. One of the first things we do when we conduct inspections is wash our hands right away when entering the booth. That allows us to verify that the water is warm, there's soap and paper towels present to easily accommodate hand washing. And then we really spend a lot of time observing food workers in action to gain confidence that the water that is present is used as needed to prevent cross-contamination of surfaces. If they're handling raw proteins, if, you know, they're able to wash, rinse, and sanitize surfaces as necessary. And then employees are maintaining employee hygiene by washing their hands when needed. When violations are observed, corrective actions are made. Most cases, these can be immediate and they are completed prior to the end of the inspection. In some cases, corrections may need more time. And if there are other inspections that we can do at the event, then the inspector will move on and conduct those inspections and then circle back around with that, you know, initial booth and verify that their corrections have been made and check in with them that way. It is rare that an event vendor that has undergone the plan review process and has a permit is in such disarray during the event itself that closure or re-inspection is necessary. We do occasionally encounter a food vendor operating without a permit. And for those vendors, if it's deemed that adequate food safety practices are in place, then we will offer them the option to purchase a permit, pay an additional fee, and undergo a full inspection. Alternatively, they can pack up their things and go home. So they've got an option. The plan review team does a lot, though, to identify the events beforehand and work with event vendors and event coordinators themselves. And so that our interaction with unpermitted vendors is less and less these days compared to what it used to be. And that is my overview of the temporary event food service component of our food safety program. Thank you for answering the slides. So if you have any questions that I can answer or any comments, I have time for that.
So, Bridget, I have a question about you'd said any food event that you see advertised or whatever, you try to touch base with them. There used to be a definition of like a private event versus a public event. So, if it's a private event for a group of people that I'm thinking like a church day camp or a church event where they're going to be serving food and bringing food and so on, do they fall under that or do they not?
There is still a definition. That's a great question. There is still a definition of private event versus public event. A private event is a pretty long definition. A handful of things fall into it. If it is like a church group advertising within their own church congregation, we'll use that example for us, anything, a evening picnic, let's say, and that advertisement is within the congregation at service, then that's a private event. But when there is a sign put up in the yard that's advertising people driving by, the general public to come also attend this barbecue, then that becomes a public event. And so there are some fine lines where, if you do certain things, you can keep it a private event and not need to go through any permitting and it becoming a public event. So we do talk with people about what their options are when we learn of an event, when we see it, however it comes across our table. We'll talk with them about what they're doing, what their intent is, and if there are some options for them to go a different direction, a non-permit direction that still works for what they're trying to achieve, then we'll give them that information too.
Thanks. And how long does the permit process take from the time that they put in their application? You indicated that it could be pretty quick if they had their application by Tuesday and they wanted to serve food on Saturday.
So to avoid the late fee, we need a 2-week window. So we ask for 2 weeks. What's today, Tuesday? If somebody submitted a plan review, we will prioritize. If somebody submits something on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday for something happening this Saturday, we're going to get it done from a temporary event standpoint. Annual permit holders is different. They go through a different permitting path. But we do really try to reach it, people in advance because it is plan review season is high. We have just the fair alone is 60 temporary event permits. And I know the fair's a ways out, but events are happening all over the place. So we try to get people submitting 2 weeks in advance so that we can take our time in doing the review and have conversation with them, right? It doesn't work out very well usually when somebody doesn't know they need a permit and they're applying on Wednesday or Thursday. Usually there's things that they hadn't thought of that we're bringing to their attention and they're kind of scrambling to get things together. So that's the other reason for our 2-week request.
Do you have other questions? Well, I have one more then.
Bring on.
It's around using commissary kitchens, and I think mostly food trucks might use that, but temporary events might too, where they prepare their food somewhere else. Can they do that anywhere? Can they do it at home? Can they do it at a restaurant?
So there are the, yes, temporary event permit holders do also need a commissary, an approved location to prepare their food. So if they have produce that they're going to be selling, they need to wash that somewhere. They can cut it on site, but usually there aren't adequate produce washing facilities at an outdoor temporary event. So they need to do that somewhere. And that's an approved kitchen. So that can be places like a restaurant. It could be an established commissary location. It could be a church kitchen, depending on the menu. Often we need people to be working at a Clark County permitted facility as their commissary location. But there are some scenarios where people can do those activities at an approved kitchen, that's not necessarily a permitted kitchen. So it could be a church kitchen. If all they need to be doing is washing produce, we can approve a variety of locations, but it's not ever supposed to be somebody's private residence. Most things with temporary events are done at the booth itself.
Bridget, I have a question.
Yeah.
I go to a lot of events that are posted on meetup.com, on meetup groups in Clark County, and many of those we bring food. And because those are advertised to the whole world, are we supposed to have permits? Because I don't have a permit
I,
to go to.
Right. It's going to be, so that's a challenge for okay. all health departments is the social media outreach.
Right.
And the promotion of things that are public events through that avenue. We can't, you know.
Okay.
Kind of police all of that. But some of the meetups might be small enough. Like it's kind of a private group too, right? Like, so the meetups are going to be real, kind of borderline for if it could be considered a private group versus where, if they weren't. Some meetup groups are thousands of people. And so it's like, do you really know the names of the people who are attending? If we try to approach it like this too, like if there was a foodborne outbreak, if tomorrow people are calling us and they got sick from your meetup, do you know who was in attendance? Like, how do you know? Can you get us a list of those people and their phone numbers and who they came with and what they brought? And if the answer is like, no, that would be really hard for us to do, then it's probably not a private event anymore.
Right.
But some of the meetups are small. They're a group of 12 people, you know, and so that really would be, yes, we know those people. We get together every month. So it kind of depends on some details of the situation.
Okay.
I'm going to wade in here as my health officer role. So I think you take a risk when you do these things because you have no idea of the way the food is prepared and whether it's prepared safely. I've been involved in, you know, foodborne outbreaks when food was not prepared safely. And I get nervous going to potlucks, even if I know, you know, my neighbor, you know, if it's neighbors or something. But when you do something like this, no, I mean, there are concerns about how the food is handled, as well as the health status of some of the folks, you know, depending on whether they have foodborne illness themselves that are preparing the food. So it's something that folks need to think about. But there's no way, I mean, if the social media stuff is all over the place and people are organizing these meet and greets, there's, we can't be every place at every time. So
I think there is also now, sorry, Alan. The recent revision of the food code included a definition of potluck, and probably what you're describing would meet the definition of potluck, which would, you know, it still comes with the risk that Alan's talking about. So, you know, eat with caution. but I think it would probably avoid the requirement to get a permit.
Okay.
But I will share my information. And if you want to talk more specifically about those things, we can look at the codes together and I can give you a better picture so that you know.
I just want to add one other point. If somebody does get sick at one of these meet and greet events, if we have no way, you know, foodborne or potential foodborne illness is a notifiable condition. Mm-hmm. Somebody comes down with a notifiable, let's say they come down with E. coli or something. For these, a lot of these social media meet, we have no way of identifying who may have been exposed or way of notifying people who may have been exposed. So in terms of our response, if there is an outbreak, it really complicates the response as well and our ability to contact people who might be at risk of foodborne illness. Okay, I'll stop there.
I added my contact information to the chat, my email and my phone number.
Right, so thank you for the contact info.
Yeah. Franklin Johnson, I see a hand.
Yes, I really appreciate the information that you shared. And dealing with our seniors and other aging populations, are there any clues or things to look for as a consumer when you're at events like this that might be a clue that maybe something isn't quite safe?
Oh, well, first look for our permit. Vendors should have a food permit posted and visible, just like they would at a restaurant. And so you can ask people. Sometimes it's tucked off in the back, but usually I would say that our permitted vendors underwent a lot to get that permit. And so they're usually pretty proudly promoting it, you know, so that people know they have it. So a permit initially, but then yes, I think observing the food workers and their hand washing practices and looking to see that people aren't touching the food that's ready to eat with their bare hands. So proper use of gloves. There's a lot of times that gloves are supposed to be changed and that hands are supposed to be washed in between. But if you take a few minutes to step back and watch the food activities that are happening behind the booth, if somebody's doing a lot of different activities and never changing their gloves, that would be a concern. If people are touching foods with their bare hands instead of using utensils, that would be a concern for me. If you don't see any kind of hand washing setup in the booth, that would be a concern for me. I'm probably not eating at those places if I see those things. Kimberly, I think your hand's up, but I think you're muted.
Oh, there I am. I have one other comment to add to that. I believe they can do some food tasks with gloves, but they can't also handle money
right.
with those gloves. So
yeah, that would require a glove change.
Yeah.
So usually, hopefully, there's somebody who's designated to handing out cups and doing the food service. And if they're going to be handling food in any way, they're either using utensils or they are frequently visiting that hand washing station.
Yeah. That's just one thing I see a lot when I go to events that makes me not eat there. Is when they're taking money and then touching the food with or without gloves. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It takes a lot of, there's a lot of activities. There's a lot going on in a food booth. So staffing can kind of be a challenge, I think, for these businesses. You know, as you see 3 or 4 or 5 people working in the food booth, and it's because they really need to have that separation of job duty.
Tracy, you have a question?
Yeah, I was just going to ask, because you're referring to hand washing stations. Can you use hand sanitizer, the foam?
No, the hand sanitizer isn't. Yeah, it's not allowed yet to replace hand washing. So in a temporary food booth, you'll usually see an insulated jug cooler that has some soap on top, paper towels somewhere nearby, and a bucket underneath it to catch the water.
The problem with hand sanitizer is, you know, when you wash your hands with soap and water, you're actually removing the organic material, which includes, you know, pathogens, and you just don't quite get that with hand sanitizer. And, you know, the big issues in terms of foodborne illness transmission are, you know, hygiene, and I hate to use the term fecal oral transmission, but people who go to the bathroom and then wash their hands and handle food. So that's one concern. Another one that's difficult for folks to evaluate is how the food is handled temperature wise over time, because bugs can grow there. And then the third one is cross-contamination. And it's not, I mean, money isn't such a big issue as going from one food to another without changing your gloves. For example, handling raw meat and then touching lettuce that isn't cooked can be, you know, Bridget, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a lot of ways to cross-contaminate food if you're not careful. So handling multiple things at one time and not using different utensils or changing your gloves would be a real problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The grill line activity can be one to pay attention to. If you are standing back and observing food handling practices for fun at an event someday, look at the, you know, is that person kind of in and out of coolers and handling garnishes and also occasionally handling raw meat too? Like, you know, they probably have a supply of hamburgers that they're going through, but then eventually they have to restock that supply from the main cooler. Are they taking the time to take off their gloves, use special utensils, wash their hands? They're really busy. That doesn't always occur. So a lot of our inspections are, we're standing back and we're observing for a while so that people, even when we're there, they return to their routine practices after a pretty brief amount of time. So if they are, doing hand washing and using certain, you know, systems, they have certain systems that they're using to help prevent cross-contamination, they're doing that whether we're there or we're not. And if they aren't, they don't have those systems in place, they are, even when we're there, they eventually return to their habit. And so we'll see bare hand contact right in front of that inspector, or we'll see somebody not wash their hands right in front of an inspector. And so a lot of what we are doing is just standing back, introducing ourselves, washing our hands, looking at some things, but we're standing back and observing for 10 minutes, 15 minutes. And that's how we get like the most informed information from our inspection. And hopefully, you know, during that time, they're cooking foods and taking, we observe them with their thermometer, taking a temperature. We can ask them what it is, or we can see them put it back on because it's not right. So we can really stand back and silently do our inspection just by observing in a lot of cases. But it makes food workers on edge a little bit. They're like, why is she just standing there staring at us? But we try to set them at ease as much as we can.
All right. Anybody else have any questions? Great conversations.
Well, thank you guys again for letting me talk about our work. And anytime you have any questions, please reach out.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bridget.
Thanks, thank Bridget. You.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's always interesting. Of course, I'm a foodie, so I love to hear all that kind of stuff. So I'm glad that she did a presentation. I hope it goes well tomorrow.
And I don't want people to be scared. I mean, they do a great job and the permitting process and the inspection process ensures that folks are safe.
Well, I think, Franklin, you had a good question and there was a good conversation around what kinds of things should we be looking for as a consumer, you know, and what kinds of things should we be looking for and maybe even mentioning to the vendor, you know, like there have been occasions where I've seen them not change their gloves or they'll touch something with their raw hand and I'll say, I don't want that. Please start over with some gloves. And they go, oh yeah, that's what I'm supposed to do. So, you know, don't be afraid to speak up if your food's not hot enough or you see a situation. So, all right. Next on the agenda is a budget update from Jeff.
I think we talk about the Commission on Aging work was back first. I'm sorry.
Yes. I'm sorry. I tend to skip things. Sorry.
It's okay. This will be really brief because we're in the process. So our work is continuing on crosswalking the Commission on Aging, the Aging Readiness Plan, and the Public Health Community Health Improvement Plan, also known as the CHIP. And the work groups are in the process of meeting and reviewing that information. And we'll be providing updates to FAC as that work continues. So the team members are meeting this Friday. And that includes, let's see, Franklin has his hand up. Franklin, who's the chair of the Commission on Aging, and Sandy, I think you'll be attending as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I'll be there, some of our team that's working on this, as well as team from the planning department, including Oliver, Dr. Oriaco, who's the head of the Department of Planning, will be meeting this weekend for additional discussion, which we'll bring back to FAC. And it looks like Franklin has his hand up, so I hope I'm not monopolizing that report there.
No problem, Dr. Milner. I was so busy taking notes from Bridget, I forgot to lower my hand. So you're fine.
Okay. So yeah, I didn't know whether you were trying to comment on this, but we'll be meeting. And again, Sandy and Franklin will be part of that with our department and the planning department. So we're looking forward to bringing more information back to FAC at our next at the next meeting.
Great. Well, thank you for that update, and I'm sorry I skipped over it. All right, now I think we're ready for Jeff and a budget update.
All right, thank you very much. We are feverishly working towards the goal of submitting a balanced budget, which is due August 12th, but there's a lot of work that goes on, obviously, between the start of the budget season and that end zone. We do have a draft balanced budget. Unfortunately, I can't get into great detail because communication on eliminated positions has not occurred. So, unfortunately, I can't get into great detail on the budget itself. I meet with our Human Resources Department on Thursday to have a conversation with them, and then I expect to start having a conversation next week with affected staff. So, I do want to share my screen and go over. We did have one-on-ones with the Board of Health regarding environmental public health fees and fee proposals. For 2025, we presented two scenarios. While I never advocate or lobby for a policy decision, in reality, the council could not charge fees at all and just fund us with general fund. It would not bother me. I don't have a dog in the fight. As long as they fund our operations, what's mandated, I'm fine. The scenario that they did sort of each provide some level of support for is the scenario I was hoping for. It does add a new program, a drinking water operations and maintenance program. So I just wanted to get through a couple things before I shared my screen. We also were meeting with two technical advisory committees tomorrow evening. That is the drinking water and on-site septic tax. I believe our school health and safety program manager is going to be presenting their draft fees to the school advisory committee as well. So between the work session with the Board of Health is July 10th. So from June 10th one-on-ones to July 10th, we also engage industry. So I will share my screen. All right. So this is, it's labeled as scenario number two. This is the scenario that received, I would say, support individually from the Board of Health members. I'm going to go through a few of these things. You'll see food safety has a pretty large individual increase in fee revenue, and I want to talk about some of these anomalies. The food safety program had been receiving federal American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA, funding for the last 2 years that funded two positions. That ARPA funding is no longer available beginning in 2025 for these positions. So we added two positions through fees to, as the program needs those positions. So, unfortunately, it's a pretty good fee increase, for food safety. School health and safety, 2.46, drinking water protection, 3.4, on-site septic, permitting, 6%. Those are fairly reasonable from what we would typically expect to see. Recreational water safety and solid hazardous waste, or solid waste enforcement, those are both over 9. Those are small programs in terms of the volume that they do. So any slight variation in volume projections or slight variation in expenses, you see a bigger impact in those fees. You'll see that the 9% is total of only $35,000, whereas the 12% in food is $368,000. That just talks about the size of the program. And even a small change in the smaller programs has a pretty large impact on the fees in the smaller programs. The other thing I wanted to point out is you'll see in the on-site septic operations and maintenance program, you'll see two lines there, one for the existing or established fees, and then one for a proposed new fee. And what that is, the new fee, we have received support for a non-compliance fee. So our on-site septic systems in Clark County have a compliance expectation that they're inspected on over certain intervals, 1, 2, or 3 years, depending on the kind of system that they are. We're at about 70% compliance in the county. So about 30% of systems around the county are non-compliant. And that's where our staff spend a lot of their time. So we were able to actually reduce the fees for those homeowners that are compliant by adding a fee for the non-compliant systems. So I just noticed Dr. Melnick's hands up. Dr. Melnick, do you want to?
Yeah, Jeff, we got a couple of new members on FAC here. So I'm wondering whether we can
talk about
FAC's role, not only FAC's role to, you know, make recommendations about the budget, but also what we mean by cost recovery and
sure, great, yeah, good point.
Would that be okay?
Sure,
sorry
yeah.
To interrupt you.
No. That's a great point. So FAC through legislative. FAC plays an advisory role to both the Public Health Department and the Board of Health related to budget and fee setting, which is actually part of our budget. So we engage FAC regularly, especially on fees over the years. The legislative process change on advising on the budget is fairly new, but we always engaged FAC on budget over the years. As far as the cost recovery goes, I'll try to be quick. Prior to 2011, programs were pretty much all at 100% cost recovery. late in 2010, the Board of Health at the time decided that the fee should only cover the fee should not cover what is considered greater good work. And greater good would be things like complaint investigations. If somebody called in and said, hey, I ate at a restaurant and got sick, or my neighbor's dumping garbage on the side of the road. And there's quite a bit of this greater good work. Foodborne illness investigations is greater good. So the Board of Health in late 2010, beginning in 2011 is when it was implemented, decided that the county general fund would pay for the greater good and the fees would not bear that cost. I sort of knew at the time what was going to happen. And it did. The general fund could no longer afford that after a certain amount of years. And we are moving back towards full cost recovery in all of our environmental health programs. So the fees, our fee process has also been looked at by the Washington State Auditor's Office on three separate occasions. And we've been given a clean bill of health on our process. There's no profit built in. These fees strictly cover just the cost of the programs. And it's based on the projected volume of work that these programs will be doing. So I think I left off. Are there any questions on any of that? I guess I can't see any raised hands. So,
Jeff, this is Jerry. I would just add real quick when we were talking about food inspections, for example, those are inspections we do. But when it comes to the on-site, when Jeff talks about, lack of compliance inspections, it's actually homeowners hiring professional inspectors to come. So we're trying to make sure those professional inspectors and the homeowners are making sure those inspections are done.
Yep, very good. The on-site septic operations maintenance program, I think I was talking about the new proposed fee. Which we got pretty good support from the Board of Health on is a non-compliance fee. So, Dr. Melnick, your hand's up again.
Yeah, I just want to mention briefly just a little bit more about the greater good. So the fees pay a little bit more than, they are based on the time and the staff costs and whatever to do the, for example, the restaurant inspections. But the greater good includes our staff, the cost to us of, if we have a foodborne outbreak related to a particular restaurant, that's a large cost involved. So that's a greater good. Same thing with a septic system that's failing that we have to take action on, takes additional staff time. So that's all built into the fees. So I just want to mention that. And I think, Jeff, you covered it. I just wanted to add a little bit more.
No problem. No problem. All right. So the existing established fees in the on-site septic operations and maintenance program, again, there was a septic operating permit that all septic owners paid, whether they were compliant or not. So beginning in 2025, assuming that the fee ordinance is approved by the Board of Health when we bring it to them in September, it'll add a non-compliance fee. So the compliant homeowners, their fee is actually going to be going down, and the non-compliant homeowners, they'll have a new fee that will be added on. Then down below, you'll see a new program, drinking water operations and maintenance. And this is it's a monitoring or operations and maintenance program for Group B water systems, which have 2 to 14 connections. And I'm not an expert on drinking water systems, but if there's any questions, I'm sure Dr. Melnick can answer those. Yes, I see your hand up, Kimberly. Dr. Dauphin.
Hi. Thank you, Jeff. I have a question about septic systems because I live in the city, so I'm not on a septic, but I have been in California, so I understand what it is. Can you tell me two things? How big is the percentage of Clark County that's on septic versus city water? And second, you said it's a non-compliance fee that's coming in, and they're supposed to have an inspection every X months or X years. Is that on the homeowner with the septic to just schedule those? Or do you have a list of who's on septic and a schedule of when you go out there? I'm just curious.
Yeah. So Let me start with the first question. There's 35, just under actually 36,000 septic systems in Clark County. Wow. I can't tell you how many people are on city sewer. I do not know the answer to that. We did a large septic reconciliation project, I think in 2013 to 2015, where we had a large number of tax parcels in Clark County that we had no record of being on septic or sewer. And actually, I like telling the story. We actually found one home that had been on city sewer since 1989 and the city had no record of it. It's just one of those weird anomalies we found. We do not actually do the inspections. It is on the homeowner to schedule that inspection. We do have a list of certified inspectors in Clark County that the homeowner can go to and pick from. Again, the inspections are either every 1 year, 2 year, or 3 year based on the type of system that they have. The state code requires inspections every 1 or 2 years, depending on system. However, we have a waiver for a certain kind of system where we're actually allowed to go every 3 years. So we're actually less stringent than what the state law calls for.
Thank you.
Jerry Scott is unmuted and can fill in, Jerry.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's a good question, Dr. Doppin.
Can I ask a little follow up though? Because I guess I don't understand if you have the compliant septic owners are getting a fee reduction and there's a new fee for non-compliance, how are you figuring out who's non-compliant?
Yeah, we have that record. So we know how many systems are not non-compliant now. So the septic inspectors have to actually send in the report for the inspection.
Okay.
Yeah. Excellent question.
I was just going to say that from what I understand across the state, we have, for Clark County, we have a pretty high compliance rate. But now we want to get it like that 25% that aren't complying through hopefully this, fee that incentivize them to get that inspection.
By the way, there's a cost to the public. I mean, one of the reasons for doing this is to this program really makes a difference. We have evidence that there's been septic contamination of some of the surface water in the county. For example, we have found coliforms in, and Jerry, correct me if I'm wrong about this, Whipple Creek, that we've been actually able to do genetic, evaluation from and identify that it's coming from human feces. So it's really important to be able to identify and bring some of these non-compliant septic systems into compliance. And really for the cost of doing this, the homeowners who have been compliant shouldn't be paying the cost of doing this. That's why we were able to reduce the fee for them and increase the fee for the non-compliant homeowners. But it really has real life implications.
Yeah, I used to have a home with a septic system, and through the routine inspection process, they identified a failing pump that cost me about $300 to replace. Whereas had it continued on and on, a new system, the system that I had was around $45,000. So I was very happy with the required inspection process. So this is, again, this is the scenario that we received the most support for, or we received support for bringing forward. So we'll be presenting the individual program scenarios to the technical advisory committees between like this week and next week. And then July 10th is the work session with the Board of Health, where that's more of a public hearing. The one-on-ones are private. The public hearing with the Board of Health is July 10th. And then last but not least, we'll bring the ordinance based on the feedback we get at the work session. We'll bring the ordinance update to the September Board of Health meeting. I do not expect any issues right now based on how the one-on-ones went. The work session will give us any additional information that we need to bring forward that ordinance in September. So if there are any questions on the budget or fees, I was hoping to be able to share a little bit more about the budget tonight, but there's some internal processes that need to occur before I can share a lot of information. So I apologize.
Are we recruiting any members for the budget committee? I didn't know what those. Roxanne's nodding her head.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, do you want to address your committee and the members and what's going on?
Yeah, I had intended to schedule a meeting between the last FAC meeting and tonight's FAC meeting. And then I realized that the idea was we would actually not ask members to take time away outside of the FAC meetings, that these would be an opportunity sort of for the committee to meet. I would entertain if someone else wanted to join. I'm hoping to send some documents to the subcommittee to review after this meeting. After I talk to human resources and some communication has occurred, I plan on sending the documents via email and then offering to meet if they have questions. The next meeting this body has is late July. And at that point, we'll be probably past the point of doing any substantive changes to the budget. It takes a couple of weeks to take everything out of our budget files and then create the work that has to go into the county budget system to submit a balanced budget. I did want to say one other thing real quick. I just realized I talked about a space planning project we had going on. It's almost complete, where we're reducing our footprint. And the budgetary savings is around $221,000 per year. So it is bearing fruit like I had hoped. That does save a couple positions.
It looks like right now your current budget committee is Elma, Kevin, Tyler, Robert, and Marla. And I have some question marks next to a couple of those names. Robert's not here tonight, but.
Yeah, at our last in-person FAC meeting where we met after the group meeting, I had a lot of people coming over to listen about budget. And I thought a couple of people, it seemed like, had some interest in possibly joining. So I wanted to open that up one more time if anybody wanted to join the budget subcommittee. The 2025 budget process, I do not anticipate being we have a balanced budget, and it's not a very difficult process this year. The 2026 budget, I've said before, is going to be far more difficult, which is still true.
Tyler, do you are you going to be on the budget committee? I have a question mark next to your name.
Yes. Yeah, I have.
Okay. And Elma? Yes. Okay.
Yep. I'm in. Yep.
And Marla?
I let Jeff know at our last meeting that I would not continue because he had a large number of people at the table and I wanted to put more energy into the bylaws.
Yeah. I think Robert is the only one that I was uncertain if he initially wasn't going to, and then I think he decided to join.
Okay. And then Dr. Fisher is on the list as well. Okay, well, we'll go with that. That's yours committee. And if anyone else wants to join that committee, I think Jeff said he's open to have another person or so join if you'd like. So, all right.
Thank you, everybody.
Questions about budget? Okay. Let's see. The next committee that we'd like to have a report from is bylaws. And Peggy Carlson and Marla and myself and Tyler, I think. Again, that's a question mark, whether you're on the bylaws / membership committee. We did merge those two committees because a lot of the work going on in membership overlapped with what was going on in bylaws. And so if you remember last meeting, we kind of went over in a lot of detail about the bylaws changes that we were proposing around changing our decision-making model from Robert's Rules of Order to consensus building. And so I heard no other comments back on what that proposal was, but there was still some concern around the 100% of the group needing to either support or I can live with a consensus decision. So the bylaws committee will be meeting before the next meeting to kind of flush that piece out. And then in July, we plan to present that to the FAC committee for a vote. And we will make sure that we send that out well in advance for you to look it over and absorb it and ask questions if you need to. And we'll give you time during the meeting as well. But that's the update on the bylaws and the membership committee. After we approve the bylaws changes for the consensus making method of making decisions, then we'll probably start looking at the bylaws around membership, because there's some conflicting things in the bylaws around membership and duties of officers and so on. So that'll be the next step. Marla, do you have anything else to add to that?
The only thing I would add is that the one thing that we want to spend a little bit more time on, and you mentioned it, Sandy, the issue of having to have 100% that can either, you know, allow or they're in agreement. We need to put a little more time to that. And when we, we're hoping that we can come up with a plan and submit it by the next meeting to the larger FAC group for a vote. I suspect what will happen is we'll agree upon something, put it into practice so we can see what we like, what we don't like, and then continue to tweak it until it really fits the design that we would want to have for a long period of time. So that's how I imagine this unfolding.
Great. Great. And then our other committee that we wanted to hear about was the Board of Health Retreat Planning Committee. And Roxanne, would you like to share what's going on with that?
Yeah, and this is one of the ad hoc committees that we put together depending on if there's some special work to be done. And so this is one of those committees. And one of the things we're doing is we're planning a retreat, an in-person retreat with the Board of Health and FAC members. And it's expected to be in probably the first quarter of 2025. We will be having some new members coming on to our council and the Board of Health. So I believe that Councillor Bowerman and Council Chair Medvedi are not running. So we will have two new members of our council and Board of Health going into next year. So the idea would be that we want to put together the plan for what that offsite will be. And then we will have an offsite retreat with our entire group and the board of the existing and then the new Board of Health members in early, first quarter of 2025. So what this committee is, the planning committee is, it's probably going to be like two or three 60-minute virtual meetings to plan the agenda. And the public health staff will do all the logistics around, getting the space and the goodies and set up the technology and all of that stuff. So we're going to be doing all of that work. But what we need from this ad hoc committee is really to work on setting the agenda. And so these two or three 60-minute meetings of FAC members will help to, identify what are going to be the priorities that we're going to be working on at that offsite. What are our goals and objectives? If there's any specific training that we feel like we would need to bring in, those sorts of things. So what I need, I do have two current members on that committee. So Councillor Marshall is representing the Board of Health. I'm reaching out to also Councillor Young. I don't know that he will have capacity. And he mentioned that to me earlier, that he may not have capacity, but I was going to give him another shout out to see if he wants to join. And he is our alternate if Sue Marshall. So Sue is on, and then Emily has volunteered. So thank you, Emily, for that as well. If anyone else would like to volunteer for that, please let me know, and you're welcome to put your hand up tonight. Or if you want to think about it, you can contact me to volunteer. We may actually, if I only end up with those two volunteers, we may actually do a little bit more outreach because I would like to have a few more members of FAC if possible to help really set that agenda. So the idea of those two or three meetings, yay, thank you, Brian. Those two or three meetings is going to be really to work with you all to set the agenda. And those meetings will be between now and probably end of October. So that's kind of the timing of what I'm looking for. And we can also determine what works best for you all regarding when those meetings will happen, whether that's in the evening or during the day or whatever. So I do see two hands up. Brian, I see your hand up, and then Nisa.
Yeah. Roxanne, I would be interested in joining the subcommittee.
Wonderful. Okay, great. Wonderful. Thank you.
I would love to help with that too, definitely.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Okay. I'm going to be sending you guys some, I don't know, chocolate or flowers or something. You know, at least a virtual emoji of that. Thank you so much. All right. Wonderful. All right. That's great. So we've got Brian and Nisa and Emily and Sue Marshall. If anyone else is interested, certainly, you know, you can throw your hand up now or you can think about it. If you have any other additional questions or any clarification you need, you can let me know. Ideally, I'll be setting up those meetings, probably the first meeting to start sometime, probably in late July at this point, sometime around that time frame. Okay, I really appreciate the interest and thanks so much, Nisa and Brian and Emily, for volunteering. And I also thank Sue. She couldn't be here tonight with us, but I've already thanked Councillor Marshall as well.
All right.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Well, as long as we're talking about needing volunteers, the Bylaws Membership Committee also needs a couple of volunteers for that committee. And again, that's a standing committee. However, our work kind of ebbs and flows a little bit. So there's like a little bit of work for a month or so, and then we don't have anything. So as soon as we get the bylaws changed for consensus building, we'll move on to membership. But if anyone's interested in joining Marla and Peggy and I, and Tyler, are you still going to be on that committee?
I mean, I was on the membership committee. I think Michael and I were the only ones on the membership committee. I was not on the bylaws committee.
And so now we've merged the two.
Yeah, I don't know if I can do both things there.
With you joining the budget committee, I wasn't sure if you were moving from one to the next. So I'll be in touch and we can visit about it. Because if you're interested in helping with the membership piece of it, we'd love to have your input. So,
okay.
You can be part of half of it.
Okay, sounds good.
Half member. All righty. Let's see, I think that's it for some of our business. The last thing on the agenda is just any kind of community updates. We're all involved in a variety of things within our own organizations or within the community. And I like to just take a few minutes to kind of go around and if anybody has anything that they want to share, an event or something that's going on in your organization that you want to share with the group, we'd love to hear about it. Don't everybody speak at once. Tracy, we'll start with you.
Hi, yeah. I just wanted to, for awareness, that Peace Health Southwest will be opening a brand new emergency department in July, but we are having an open house for the community on Friday. So it's a chance to get like a sneak peek at the new emergency department, and we're going to have a fire department. We're going to be doing helmet fitting for kids and those types of things. So it'll be fun. It's Friday afternoon. I believe it's from 4 to 7, somewhere around there, but it is at the Peace Health Southwest Medical Center in the new emergency department. So if any of you are around and want to see what it's going to look like, it's a great thing for the community, lots more space. So
yay, thank you. That sounds fun. Kimberly.
Hi, I just wanted to say I always like to update you on zoonotic conditions or diseases or syndromes that could be transmitted between animals and people because I do the animal part. But in the last month or so, I've seen several cases of scabies in dogs and one in a cat. And this is a burrowing mite that can also affect people. It's a really itchy rash, and it's really easily transmitted between people, between animals, and then also between people and animals. So I just wanted to let you know that it's been, I can't even remember the last time I saw it. It's been several years, but I saw three in the last month.
Hey, Dr. Dauphin, how do you, what is the treatment with regard to that?
I don't know what the treatment in people is. The treatment in animals is usually a drug called ivermectin. There are some other drugs that newer ones available. I don't have them at my mobile clinic. They're a little pricier. And because I work at a low-cost clinic, I don't have those newer expensive drugs because it defeats the purpose of having a low-cost clinic. So there are some other medicines available. Dr. Melnick may be able to chime in on that.
Yeah, there's a topical agent called permethrin that's used to treat
Okay.
scabies.
Yeah. In addition to ivermectin, many of the newer prescription flea and tick medicines will also work to help with scabies.
Yeah, it's kind of a pain in the neck because you have to, the scabies, they get into your bedding and your sheets and all that. So you have to not only treat yourself, and anybody who's, in your household who may have it, as well as you got to wash everything in hot water and hot dryer. It's a yeah, there's a you can talk to your physician about it, but it's yeah. I wasn't aware that scabies jump was zoonotic and jump from animals to humans. So you just taught me something there.
Yeah. Also, ringworm. I've seen
Yeah.
not as many, but ringworm, of course, is not a worm. It's a like a fungus. And in humans, it is a pink circle that shows up, but in animals, it's just really scabby hair loss. So it looks different in animals, but it's the same organism and very highly contagious, especially to children.
If I, back to scabies, as humans, I would not take ivermectin. Just,
No, I was not
yeah.
recommending that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Permethrin is topical.
Yeah.
So.
So on a dog, if you see scabies, it's a rough, scaly patch. Maybe the hair's fallen out in that area.
Yes, the challenge in animals is that many of these ectoparasites, these external parasites, have look all the same on presentation. So it can be scabby or scaly or crusty or bald hair loss. And I can't rule in or rule out any one of fungus or a parasite or even an endocrine or hormonal disease like thyroid disease without doing tests. So on animals, the jury is out until I figure it out. I think in humans, it tends to be more pathognomonic, meaning certain things show up a certain way and you can kind of guess before you test. But I like ringworm looks like ringworm in humans. Whereas if you have scabies, it looks different in humans. But in animals, everything shows up as scabby or bald.
Okay. All right, great. Anybody else?
By the way, I
Well,
think ivermectin can be used for people, with HIV who have a severe scabies infestation, and but that's something to talk to your doctor about. Not, yeah.
ivermectin, it has a very useful drug in animals. I don't know about its use in humans. I think it's much more limited
Yep.
and very particular usage. Yeah. Whereas animals, we actually use it quite a bit, especially in large animal. Yeah.
And whatever you see on social media, do not use ivermectin for COVID-19.
Right.
Please. Yeah.
Please don't.
Well, I just have one thing is I've announced in the past the Food System Council sponsors an event every other month at the Heathen Brewery brewery downtown. It's called Eat, Drink, and Be Local, and it's talking about local food access and local foods. And this month's topic is going to be all about berries. So they're going to talk about berries grown in Clark County and where you can find them, how you store them, what are some things to do with them. We'll be having some taste testings of some sort. And this will be on July 10th at Heathen Brewing from 5:30 to 7:30. And so anybody that wants to come and join us, it's open to the public. And we don't serve the food. You can buy the food at Heathen Brewery. And then we have a ways to serve our taste testings. But this month, it's all about berries. And the one after that, which will be in August, I believe, is going to be about tomatoes, I think. So, but I'll announce it in July. Next one is. But if you want to know anything more, just let me know if you need more details.
Sandy, you said we don't need to RSVP. We can just show up?
Nope, just show up.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And if the weather's nice, which I assume it will be, we'll be in the outdoor patio area.
Okay.
Yep, we'd love to see you there. All right, anybody else? All right. Our next meeting is going to be July 23rd, and that one's going to be virtual. And then the one on August 27th will be in person, and the location will be is yet to be determined. But we'll be sure to let you know next time where that'll be. But you can plan for an in-person meeting in August, and our next meeting will be virtual on July 23rd. And with that note, we'll adjourn the meeting and have a great month with all your summer fun.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
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 Happy summer.
Bye-bye.